Marty in the Morning on RTE Lyric FM with Spry Finance. Keep living the life you love.
Now, 8.57 it is, 8.57 it is. Now, I'm delighted to say I have the very wonderful Mr. Eamon Carr in front of me this morning. Eamon, firstly, can I say, you're looking terrific.
You're very kind.
Not at all, I'm serious. And secondly, you have written this book, Pure Gold, Immemorable Conversations with Remarkable People. And I would always think, what would be the opening line of a book? The opening line of this book, right, I have to tell everybody, is, where is it now? I was in a broom closet with an older man. That is your opening line.
There you go.
You had me at the beginning.
And it's a true story.
But it's a great
You better
story.
Tell them who the man is.
The man is Gay Byrne.
The man is Gay Byrne
the legend of this parish.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a great story of doing an interview with the greatest interviewer
he was just astonished.
He was, yeah. And as you say correctly in the book, he had this ability to have this lovely chat with somebody as an interviewer and throw in the zinger.
Oh, a total zinger.
Didn't he?
Oh, yeah. You had to be on your marks with Gay.
Yeah, you did. Mary Finucane had that too.
And there are a lot of people who...
That's right.
I mean, look, I only came to this sort of almost accidentally. It was an accidental...
Were you?
Interviewer. Yeah. I mean, after Horselips, I wound up writing occasional features, music columns and so on for the Evening Herald.
But you're not in the Herald every week.
Oh, I was, but it was handy stuff. I mean, I was doing writing about music. You know, I could do that in my ear.
Okay.
And which is probably why I was there. And doing book reviews and theatre reviews, that sort of stuff.
Sure.
And occasional features. And then one day, the editor, Michael Deneve, called me in and he said, I have an idea, boss. And I said, tell us, what's that? And he said, I want to... double-page feature every week, an interview with a famous person. I said, well, it sounds interesting, all right, but I want you to do it. I said, Michael, no.
Right, yeah.
And he said, now, the thing is, he said, we won't just do the normal flim-flam and colourful copy. You have to ask the questions. We'll have question and answer format. So you need to ask a lot of questions and coax a lot of good answers.
Sure.
And I said, but I'm not cut out for that. I mean, the idea of actually asking people personal questions...
I know.
..or probing questions, it just wasn't in my nature.
But he saw it as something that would be in your nature.
Well, maybe he was stuck. I don't know. I got pushed into the gig.
But the point is that you did it, and you must have been up the wall doing it.
Oh, it drove me mad.
Yeah.
And initially.
Only initially.
But the funny thing is, I began to learn... as I went along, and then you begin to sort of, you know, think it through.
Yes.
And you get on your marks, and after a while you realise, you know, the other thing is, after work you would go to the Oval Bar where all the other hacks were.
Right.
And these are all pros. These are all professionals. These are all around the block.
Yeah.
And so you had to hold your own. And if you weren't up to speed, it was a bit like a football dressing room. If you weren't up to speed...
That's true.
You'd be told quickly enough.
The people that are in the book, it's called Pure Gold, by the way, and I've gone through it. And for instance, I loved... You talk about Frank Kelly and Dermot Morgan, who were, again, wonderful characters, both of them, wonderful characters. And you correctly say that you said you loved meeting Dermot Morgan, bursting with live wire ideas. Anytime you'd meet Dermot, there was just a list. And this was pre-Father Ted.
Oh, pre-Father Ted.
He would have a list of things that he was determined to do.
He would, whenever you would bump into him, he would appear in front of you and within, 3 minutes, he'd have morphed into about five different characters.
Yeah.
And bouncing these astonishing lines. So you're laughing.
That's
probably
right.
Like meeting Harpo Marx or Groucho Marx or that. I mean, you're just laughing from the get-go.
But he was on all the time.
And he was trying out material. He was sussing you out.
Exactly what he was.
And he'd be doing the football voice. And he'd be doing the Priestine voice. And he's doing everything. And you couldn't get a word in edgeways.
No, he was magnificent. He really was. And Frank Kelly, you talk about Frank Kelly in the book. And I love the way you've written it. You do it as a story, but it's the setup that you do. So you bring us into how the interview happened and where you were and you were then, and where you, you know, so we don't just get the Q&A here,
well,
we get the setup.
Yeah, that wasn't so much my idea, to tell you the truth.
Pretend it was your idea.
Sheena Quinn, who was a commissioning editor at Merion, said, Eamon, you should tell the story behind the interview.
I think that's very clever.
And I said, yes. Right, okay. She said, because I've heard you tell a couple of yarns.
Yes.
And I said, right, well, yeah, okay, I'll try that. So anyway, I had a big box of tapes because I kept all the cassettes.
Yes.
And I listened back to the stuff and I selected 15 of the, you know, the better interviews, the ones that stood up.
Sure.
And then I just started telling the yarn about how these things came together. And then a few other yarns get thrown in and then other stuff would pop into your head and you put that
that's
in as
right.
well.
And also and there's other people in the book that aren't necessarily part of the interview, but they're just part of the story, which is very interesting
as
well.
Yeah, for sure.
That was
for sure. Now, there's one woman that people said to me, who is that? Who is Sheila Mooney? Now, you had Guy Barker on there not
yes,
so long
did,
ago,
right.
and you were talking about Sinatra.
Yes.
So you know the way you make connections.
That's right.
So, Sheila Mooney was actually Maureen O'Sullivan's sister. Maureen O'Sullivan was the actress who went to Hollywood in the 30s and played Jane to Tarzan right?
Correct, yes.
And she was the mother of Mia Farrow. Right?
Who so, I have interviewed.
Oh, there you go,
there you
right.
Go.
No, there's the connection now.
Yeah.
So as it turns out, Sheila Mooney, a wonderful woman, a really sweetheart.
Yes.
But there were two things that stood out for me. One was the knocking on the coffin, right? Where her grandfather had been a major in the British Army in China and was driven out during the Boxer Revolution, came back to Roscommon and so on. But he had an interest in spiritualism. Anyway, when he died and he was in the coffin and the funeral was on, they heard this knocking coming from the coffin. And anyway, they buried him. And I said, well, you know, I mean, what about the knocking from the coffin? Oh, my grandmother thought that was just his interest in spiritualism and he was communicating from beyond the grave to let us know that he was all right.
And he's still buried.
And he was buried close up. I shouldn't be laughing.
But he's gone now.
I shouldn't be laughing. But the other one was, after Maury was a big hit in Hollywood, Sheila, who's the younger sister, decided she'd give it a go. So she did a little bit of acting lessons here and went over to Hollywood in the 30s. And she was a very innocent young woman, right? And she met Louis B. Mayer, right, the head of one of the studios.
Who wouldn't be an innocent?
And she asked him, she said, I would love to see your horses. And he said, horses? She said, yes, I'd love to see your horses. What horses? And she said, oh, well, I've heard everybody talking about your stables. And of course, they were talking about the stable of starlets that was on the casting couch.
That is.
It was before the Me Too movie. So she was incredibly innocent. Anyway, she got out of there. She was back in Ireland. Anyway, sorry. I have to say about her because she was a really lovely, lovely woman.
Oh,
and she's in the book with great yarns.
Oh, that's a great one.
And a tragic story as well.
I can think of no other way to introduce trouble with a capital T than your story does there. Trouble with a capital T. I'm talking with Eamon Carr this morning. Pure Gold is the name of his new book, Memorable Conversations with Remarkable People. One of the people in here that, well, there's so many to mention. I love, John Mortimer's in here. John Mortimer. I've never met John Mortimer.
He was fantastic.
Very funny, yeah, dry humour, I believe.
Hilarious.
And we're talking Rumpole the Bailey here for anybody who doesn't.
Yes, Rumpole of the Bailey.
Yes.
And I said, Rumpole of the Bailey, I presume, you know, you're famous right around the world. He said, oh yeah, he said, I forget, somewhere in the middle of the Far East. Yes. Recently, he said, and a woman in the restaurant said, ah, Rumpole of the Bailey. And he put on the accent. He was great. And there was a Rumpole of the Bailey fan club in San Francisco, and they have annual general meetings, and they brought him over for one of them.
Wow.
He was such a character.
Yeah.
But his own little memoir books are wonderful and hilarious.
Very funny man.
And very well written.
And to see him initially, you would think he would be austere, stern.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you wouldn't
Not
you
at
wouldn't
all. He was, well, he was the original champagne socialist, you know.
Of course.
And oddly enough, people tend to forget this. The man who wrote, you know, all the Rumpole series defended the Sex Pistols.
Yes.
Because there was trouble with the first album sleeve, and it was in Nottingham, in some shop in Nottingham, that's been sued.
Don't put it out.
And he was called, and he stood up and he explained that the word bollocks was a medieval word for the rigging of a schooner.
Mm,
and the judge says,
yeah,
and case dismissed.
That's right. And we remember they had the sticker over the album.
That's correct.
If I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Talk to me about Eartha Kitt. Now, Eartha Kitt, how did you meet her? How did that happen?
I have no idea.
Right,
she was in town and she was obviously doing some promotion, but I couldn't remember.
Was she on stage?
There was
maybe?
No indication.
She must have been
doing
a show.
No, maybe. It was a flying visit.
Okay.
It was a flying visit.
So you got wind of it or somebody?
So, yeah, I don't know who put me in touch with her. No, somebody somebody did. Somebody obliged.
Sure.
And so I arrive at a hotel and, you know, I get shown up and I knock on the door and I go,
Is that you or Eartha Kitt?
Right at the door. And anyway, she was inside purring.
She was a purrer, yeah.
God. And then in I go. And she was so informal that it was frightening.
Yes.
I mean, sit down. So I'm sitting in an armchair and she sort of curls up at my feet. It was unbelievable. In a sweater and slacks and on a rug. And it was as if it was, you know, 3 a.m.
And
we were just
mates.
After coming back from a nightclub and we were friends and we were just chatting. Unbelievable stories, you know. And, you know, then she was, then starts telling me about we started talking about James Dean. And then, you know, one thing led to another. And then she started, out of the blue, she starts talking about Hilton Edwards and Micheál McLeamore.
Good Lord.
And she'd worked with them. She'd worked with on stage with McLeamore on the continent. I think it was in Germany. But something that, what's his name? Oscar Wilde, Orson Welles.
Right.
Orson Welles had been directing something and they were all in it.
Isn't that amazing?
Isn't that astonishing? Yeah. I'm sitting there being jaw hanging open.
You know, it's funny, you're sitting there. Today is what, Thursday, Tuesday, Monday. Mary Cockton was in. Was it Monday she was in? And she started talking about a movie she made with Peter O'Toole. And I was just blown away.
I know,
all this stuff that we forget that we. You go, hang on a second, weren't you in? Yes, I was.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
Eartha Kitt, we've just been told, Eartha Kitt was a guest on The Late Late Show. She started a gay bar and performed one of her hits, Champagne Taste. She was in Dublin for performances at the Gaiety. But 87?
No, this was later.
Later, okay.
Yeah, this was, in my case, this was later.
Right.
It might have been around 90 or 91 or something like that. No, I think she was only in a flying visit. She was a bit hoarse and she picked up some sort of a bug travelling.
Yeah.
She was complaining about airports.
Did you like her?
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely, but you know, someone that you would love to have as a friend.
Yes.
She was charismatic.
Well, she certainly seemed to be quite friendly towards you.
She was just charismatic. I think she was just a normal.
Absolutely,
but hugely talented. I took that from almost took it for granted.
Yeah, Joni Mitchell talks about the star maker machinery. She wasn't using that. She was just being a normal, straightforward person.
Yeah.
Which is quite lovely.
Which is fantastic. And when you meet that, you really appreciate it.
It is lovely, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is lovely.
Because sometimes you meet characters who are full of it.
People always say that the people that you meet who aren't the bothersome ones are the ones who are at the top.
Yeah.
It's the ones who are just nearly there.
Who are
still searching for whatever. Here's a little bit of the woman herself.
can kiss me on a Monday. A Monday, a Monday is very, very good. Or you can kiss me on a Tuesday. A Tuesday, a Tuesday. In fact, I wish you would. Or you can kiss me on a Wednesday. A Thursday, a Friday. And Saturday's the best. But never, never on a Sunday. A Sunday, a Sunday. 'Cause that's my day of rest. Most any day you gotta be my guest. Any day you say, but my day of rest. Just name the day that you like the best. Only stay. You can kiss me on a cool day, a hot day, a wet day, whichever one you choose. Or try to kiss me on a grey day, a May day, a payday, and see if I refuse. And if you make it on a bleak day, a freak day, a weekday, why, you can be my guest. But never, never on a Sunday, a Sunday, the one day I need a little rest. But never, never on a Sunday, a Sunday, 'cause that's my day of rest.
There she is. That's Eartha Kitt, your friend. Eartha Kitt, and Never on a Sunday. How lovely it is. I'm chatting with Eamon Carr. It's Pure Gold. That's the name of the book. Jack Charlton, Eartha Kitt, Shane McGowan. Fascinating.
Shane and I...
And you did Q&A on this one now.
I had to do Q&A on this because I wanted people to get the full fruit flavour of a conversation with Shane.
May I say, very gentle, I felt, the conversation. I mean, he would say what he wanted to say, of course, but he'd question you, but he'd prod, but he'd still give.
Yeah, well, the thing about it is, I knew Shane when he was a teenager.
Okay.
And he was working... selling records on a record stall in Soho.
Okay,
right?
Yeah.
And the stall was owned by Ted Carroll from Dublin, who went to London with Skid Row, the beat group in the 60s.
Sure, sure.
And opened an oldies record shop in Camden Town called Rock On.
Okay.
And then this was the Rock On stall.
I understand.
And Philip Lynott sings about it in The Rocker. I get my records at the Rock On stall.
Yes.
That was it.
Okay.
And Shane used to work there in the 70s. Is that amazing?
Mm, yeah.
Sorry, I'm bringing it all together.
No, it's totally new.
So I used to know him then. He was an erudite guy, really well read, knew everything about music, He was a total fan, knew everything. And was very well read with all the poets and all the Irish writers and so on. And then he had a band called the Nips, right? And a sort of a punk band. But he was a sort of a punk around town. He was a sort of a well-known face. And... anyway, the next thing is, he was saying to me, rehearsing this new band, you want to come down to rehearsals?
Careful on the quotes now, yeah.
And it was the Pogues.
Right,
Pogue Mahone.
Yes, indeed.
In the early days. And we were good friends, and I wound up actually playing with the Pogues.
Did you?
Yeah, I did.
Okay, I didn't know
I was
that.
To do it. Shane asked me to do a tour. Their drummer, Andrew, was ill.
Yes.
And they were doing a tour of Scandinavia.
Right.
And they rang me and said, listen, would you sit in? And I couldn't go. I had other commitments just at that time, and I couldn't go. Anyway, probably just as well. Who played the drums? Elvis Costello.
Go away.
Yeah, but I think there was only like maybe one gig.
Right.
Because I think Shane fell over and hit his head. And the rest of the tour was cancelled.
What a surprise.
Well, anyway, so I wound up, eventually, Andrew couldn't make a flight to Dublin. And I wound up playing with when the Dubliners and the Pogues played together. And I'm in the back, playing the drums. It was great crack.
With the Seven Drunken Nights and all that carry on.
Yeah, the Irish Rover.
The Irish Rover. That's what it was. Yeah.
And anyway, back to the story with Shane. So anyway... I've been at a reception for Faber and Faber had published a book of Shane's lyrics, which was well deserved.
Yes.
And
it sounds like a beautiful book.
Oh, yes, gorgeous. And Seamus Heaney's on Faber and Faber, you know. So anyway.
Yes.
So I said to Frank Murray, who was the manager, Frank, I probably should really do an interview with Shane for the Herald because it'll help sell tickets for the SFX, you know,
yes,
or whatever
of course,
in Dublin.
A great venue, yes.
And Frank said, oh, yes, great idea, great idea. But I sort of knew Shane. I knew him very well. And we maybe had a few late night, you know, tinctures and so on and so forth. And anyway, Shane sort of agreed. And then he arrived for the interview with two bottles of hooch.
Oh, gosh.
In the afternoon.
Yeah.
And he was a reluctant interviewee. And I think it was he was just embarrassed.
Right.
And he was suddenly, he was being interviewed by someone that he thought was maybe a mate or a colleague or a fellow traveller, you know.
Real question.
And so, I mean, so the, anyway, the exchanges, it's more that there are exchanges rather than an interview, you know.
Yeah.
And it was, but the weird thing was, you know, I sensed there was something happening.
Yeah.
And he was afraid that I was going to maybe ask awkward questions. I didn't, to be honest.
I understand.
But within 6 months, they had fired the manager, and the album they were working on was his last album, and I didn't know that. So, anyway.
But I mean,
it's
there.
It's a very timely interview.
Yeah, but you were there to talk about the book.
I was there to talk to him about the book and about where they were going.
And where the book, of course, because you were broad as any interviewer
essentially,
would.
And his influences and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
And he was trying to stonewall a lot of the stuff, but at the same time, there was great affection, and you know, we had a bit of crack.
But he seems to have been, and I never met him, and everybody says that he, when you got through all the other nonsense, if you will, there was this lovely guy inside, that he was a very, very warm, very erudite, very bright, very interesting.
All of that.
Interesting.
All of the above. No, he was a fascinating guy. He was incredibly well-read.
Yes,
one of the other things. And he had a huge span of interests. And he wrote some incredible songs.
And some of the lyrics are just
absolutely incredible.
Forever and ever.
And the look of the band. I mean, don't forget, you know, he'd been in a punk band with the Nips and jumping around. It was a psychobilly, whatever it was, moddy type of thing. And they were great. But suddenly this other thing that developed. Now, this was the very early Pokes.
Yeah.
And Spider was banging his head with a metal tray and
percussion.
I mean, they were fantastic. I mean, they were genuine. I went to so many of the early gigs, you know, and in little places, with maybe 50 or 60 people there.
Yeah.
Energy levels were huge. And then I was lucky, I was able to graduate with them, and I went, you know, Light a Big Fire went on tour with them, and I was on that tour with them.
But he would open up to you. He would talk to you because
We did a lot of talking late at night in the likes of Bloom's Hotel at 5 in the morning. But when it comes to an interview, that was when it became very difficult.
Yeah, can be guarded. People can be guarded.
Oh yeah, but he knew it was going to be down in print.
Yeah. It's a lovely read, but that interview is—it's a lovely read, and again, it's the as you say, it's as you phrase it. He did it in his own unique flavour, is how you put it in the book, and I think that's very true because he was unique.
Oh no, totally unique.
Totally
and
unique.
I mean, it's not that he's unsung. I mean, people do appreciate.
No.
People do appreciate.
Not that.
I mean, people like Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen, everybody actually appreciates what he did because he was
true.
So magnificent.
It's so true. Will you stay with me for a few more minutes?
Oh, yeah, please.
Good man.
Yeah.
We have traffic. There are people moving.
Lyric FM Traffic and Travel, sponsored by Citroën. Let the revolution begin with the all-new Citroën C3.
There you are now, Sinead.
Hello again, Marty.
Hello there now. We're going down memory lane here, myself and Eamon Carr. What have you got for me?
Well, there are inbound delays in Dublin this morning on the N7 between Junction 5 at Go and Junction 3 City West. An earlier collision there has been cleared. It's slow on the Finglas Road between Glasnevin Cemetery and Hart's Corner, and on the Grand Canal inbound as well between Portobello Bridge and Leeson Street. To Galway, where there are delays on the Old Dublin Road inbound from the Skerrett roundabout to the Bonds. And on the Tuam Road inbound as well between Ballybrit and Bohir na Drabh. To Limerick, where it's busy on the Childers Road eastbound between the Kilmallock roundabout and the Tipperary roundabout. Same story on the Corbally Road southbound this morning, where you could be delayed travelling from Westbury to Athlunkert Bridge. And finally in Cork, there's an inbound queue on the North Ring Road approaching Tinker's Cross. And that's the latest traffic and travel news this morning.
That's fantastic. You'll be with me tomorrow. Making a special pilgrimage to the studio tomorrow.
Special appearance on the Friday.
It's lovely to see.
I don't have a long weekend. Oh, man.
It's lovely to see you working. It's marvellous. Thank God we're all working. Isn't that the bottom line, Sir Joe?
There you go.
Keep the face.
I look forward to the chuckles song.
Alrighty. I have to play Rain, Light and Soho, or at least a little bit of it.
loving you a long time. Down all the years, down all the days, and I've cried for all your troubles. Smile at your funny little ways. We watched our friends grow up together, and we saw them as they fell. Some of them fell into heaven, some of them fell into hell. I took shelter from a shower, and I stepped into your arms. Night in Soho, the wind was whistling all its charm. I sang you all my sorrows, you told me all your joys. Whatever happened to that old song, to all those little girls and boys. Sometimes I'd wake up in the morning, the ginger lady by my bed, covered in a cloak of silence.
Rainy Night in Soho, music from Shane McGowan and the Pogues. Eamon Carr is with me. Listen, just to finish up, Jack Charlton. Jack Charlton is, as we know, one of the greats, a raconteur beyond compare. You had a good time with him.
I know. I mean, look, in at the deep end, right, yes, on this interview, Lark, right, and the editor says, tell you what to do, make a list of people and, you know, and have a think about it. And I said, right, who are the pair? And this was 1989.
Yes.
Before Italian 90. Right. Who would be the person that you think, you know, like to interview most? And I said, well, myself. I said, oh, I'd love to interview Jack Charlton. Anyway, so I get Jack's number.
And he's now in...
And he's back in England.
Yeah, sorry,
in Yorkshire. And so I rang up, being a big idiot. I rang the house. And I said who I was and what I wanted. And he... expletives.
Oh, right.
Expletives. A string of expletives. Oh, and it was like, bloody hell, if you're not got enough effing interviews with me over there. And I went, oh, my God. I sank.
Yes, yeah.
And I thought, well, what do I say? So I said, I don't want to know about the hamstrings or the squad or that's the injuries it. Or any of that stuff. I don't want to know any of that. I just want to talk to you about Nat Lofthouse and
yes.
Tom Finney and Billy Wright.
Yeah.
All right, okay then. Tell you what, see you in the hotel on Sunday. Good luck. Put the phone down. I went, hotel? What's he talking about? Right. Anyway, he was over then on the weekend in preparation for a match against West Germany, as they were at the time.
Yeah.
And so I rang him at the hotel and I waited all day. I was saying, what's the best time to ring him? I rang him around 5:30. I woke him up. Joking. He was having a nap.
Wouldn't be pleased.
And, come up to the room. Jack, I'm in Ranelagh, not at the airport. All right, okay, come on. So I went over anyway. Come in, have a bit of dinner. Jack, I wouldn't interview a man eating his dinner. So go and have your dinner. Have a cup of tea, we'll talk later. You bloody well come effing in and you'll have your effing dinner.
Isn't that gas?
Went in, sat down. Morris Setters, his assistant manager, was there.
Yeah.
And Stan in, he says to Setters. And I said, he said, I don't know, boss. I said, yeah, he's in the bar. I said, oh, with his parents having a glass of water, you know, and mineral. All right. And I remembered that I'd seen him, Staunton, play. I think it was his first or second international friendly against Tunisia.
Yes.
There was hardly anyone at the match one afternoon. And he kicked a ball from the Havelock Square. It was a sort of a free, and he kicked at him. And the ball lofted over midfield. It nearly went out towards the dart, right? And I'm sitting in seats behind the dugout. And Charlton and Setter stood up and looked at each other and went, because they were astonished. They'd never seen, this was a GAA footballer kicking a ball, right? And so I remarked on this, you see, to show that I sort of maybe knew a little bit about the football
business.
I'm part of
your world,
you see.
Yes.
And I said, remember that match against Tunisia when he kicked the ball over the line? Yugoslavia. No, Jack, it was Tunisia. It was Yugoslavia. And then I suddenly realised I was having an argument.
That's right.
So I backed off. I said, listen, sorry, Jack, you're the boss. You're the gaffer, I mean, you know. And he looked at Setters and he says, well, who was it? He said, the lad's right, boss.
The lad's right, boss.
And he looked at me and he said, have you a tape recorder? I said, me bag. Put it up there, he says. Put it up.
It's like you proved yourself.
I don't know, but yeah, I put the tape up anyway. Yeah. He started rabbiting. I could have asked him anything. In fact, I more or less did.
Yes, yes.
And he went on. I had a C90, 90-minute cassette in my little Pro Walkman. And it ran out. I was kicking myself. First thing I learned was bring a spare tape.
Isn't
because
that?
I was expecting to get 10 minutes.
Of course you were.
And he talked about everything. Once or twice, I had to lean forward and turn off the tape because I said, I don't want this on tape, Jack.
Okay, all right. Because he was giving you stuff.
Oh, some of the stuff. I couldn't use it. And we'd all be in jail. And
again,
we'd be cancelled.
Yeah, and again, somebody who had, it would appear, this gruff manner. But inside was quite a different person.
He was sensitive. And
he
didn't,
sensitive.
Well, he wouldn't want to let on. But there was I'm remembering some of the mad stuff, but there was one funny little exchange.
Loads of this in the book, by the way.
I asked him, by the way, Jack, are there any players that you'd like to have played with? You know, as a footballer yourself. What about Pele? Would you like to be on a team with Pele?
But this is George Best.
I said, and George Best. I said, what about Pele and George Best? Would you like to play with them? And he stopped and there was a pause. I went, oh God, there's something here. There's trouble coming. And because he could be volcanic, you know?
Yes.
And he went, I don't know about George Best, he said. George doesn't like me.
Yeah.
I've only met him once or twice. I don't know him. He says, I don't know the lad. He said, but I would never have him on my team. He's too undisciplined. He started ranting about Best, you see.
Lack of discipline.
But the funny thing wasn't just the lack of discipline. I thought I understood all that. But he said, when he was doing all that farting around, he says, you know, he says, all our wives thought that we were doing the same thing.
Oh, he's getting everyone
into
trouble.
All our wives thought we were doing the same thing, and we weren't doing the same thing. He said, we'd have the odd drink, weren't doing that.
Isn't that funny?
So it was brilliant. The boys were worried that their wives are getting under them and saying, are you at the same carry-on as George Best?
And there was
isn't
the reason.
Lovely?
Isn't that lovely? Isn't it? It's a gorgeous read. Can I just congratulate you on it, Eamon? I'm loving it. It's going to my holidays as well because I want to read it properly. But it's you, Willie Russell in there. You have, and you've incidentally, Mad Frankie Fraser. That's for another day's work. Rudolf Nureyev, Jamaican, got you that.
No,
so much. Thank you so much for coming in.
No, I've been enjoying myself.
Continue good health to you, sir.